Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because I get to talk to Dr. Heather Aku about her book titled On the Job, A History of American Work Uniforms, published by Bloomsbury in 2024. This book does, I mean, what it says on the title, which is pretty straightforward, Understanding the History of American Work Uniforms. That title, however, doesn't necessarily make it sound as cool as all of the work uniforms actually are. Getting into the book, thinking about changing styles, the impact of business practices, the actual experience of being in the uniforms, how they're made. There's so much to get into with this. So Heather, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It's always wonderful to have questions with new people and get new questions.
Wonderful. Well, I'm afraid we're going to start off with probably a question that's not particularly new, but Okay. Could you please introduce yourself a bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
For sure. So I am an associate professor of fashion design at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. So that's in the United States. I decided to write the book. I've been a professor at IU since 2004. And my early research was completely on African fashion and contemporary Islamic fashion, so very different from this book. And in 2017, I became the director of our fashion collection, and I held that position for 4 years. And I actually had never expected to hold that position because the Sage Collection only collects Western fashion. And up to that point, I had never done any research about Western fashion. So I decided to be really curious about it and to investigate the history of the collection and why it looks the way that it does. And I guess I had been in that position for maybe a year and a half, 2 years. And I had started teaching a class on autobiographies of dress in the body, where I asked students, we actually read together in class, and we read autobiographies from diverse perspectives, not really written as fashion books, but to help understand different ways that people exist in the world and why they dress the way they do and why they think about their bodies even the way they do. And we were reading a book called Hand to Mouth by Linda Tirado. She is now a journalist, but she wrote about her experience as a very working class woman working a series of terrible food service jobs. And I started imagining what the uniforms must have been like. And then I thought, I wonder if we have anything like that in our fashion collection. Probably not. And that just sparked something into me to go investigate. And I found a early 1980s Burger King uniform on eBay, which was a place that my family went to all the time. And I was just so fascinated, not only, being able to find these vintage work uniforms, but also like, well, why aren't they in collections? And why is this not represented in the fashion research? Because this is the landscape of my childhood. And suddenly I was really excited about the opportunity to do something in American history that was like restoring, you know, it suddenly made sense to me why I was always really bored in history class, because it was never really about the things that I knew from my own personal experiences.
Hmm. Very interesting backstory. Thank you for starting us off with that.
Sure.
Can we get into, again, what sounds like a really boring question? I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, but is, I think, both important for the rest of our conversation. And the answer, I think, is less boring than the question. So can you walk us through how you define uniforms and which ones you focus in on the book and why you chose those?
For sure. That's actually not a boring question at all. I completely agree that this is really fundamental to the conversation. And actually, they're a little harder to define than you might think. So there has not been a lot of research about uniforms of any kind in fashion studies or really in other academic disciplines. There was some work starting in the 80s and 90s. They never included photographs. So it was really a lot of kind of personal musing, theoretical musing about uniforms and what they mean in society and where they come from. But really nothing about the aesthetics or like concretely, how are they made and what is it like to wear them? And they also tended to focus on military uniforms, which I am also really interested in. The military is a kind of job too, but they have a very different function from the work uniforms that I was looking at. There is some literature that started a bit later. Jennifer Craik published a book about work uniforms. Jane Tynan and Lisa Godson published a great book about uniforms a few years ago. That was an anthology. But those books, while they did finally include some images, didn't focus still on work uniforms. There was a lot about school uniforms, sports uniforms, lots of other kinds of uniforms. Jane Tynan is wonderful, and her focus has really been on military uniforms. I invited her to campus, and we had some really great conversations about our shared interests. But, you know, again, none of this literature really prepared me to think about, well, how would I define a work uniform? And I think what is really important to know, and this is something I've even been reflecting on with my students, is that it's not really the clothes themselves that make something a work uniform. A work uniform could be anything. It doesn't have to be something that's radically different from what people wear in fashion circumstances or just in their ordinary everyday life. But what makes something a work uniform is when you have an adult telling another adult what to wear and requiring them to appear in a certain way, which in our personal lives is a level of coercive control that many people would not accept. But in our work lives, we're like, yep, okay, boss is telling me I have to wear this. I guess I have to wear it. You might not like it, but you're probably going to, you know, resolve yourself to wearing that as a condition of employment, because that is a widely accepted idea that it's okay for bosses to ask for that kind of thing.
All right. That's a really helpful definition to be getting on with. As we especially go into different workplace settings, I think it's so helpful to have that framing of kind of the power and control as an overarching idea as we look at it in different contexts. Because as you said, it is kind of definitional. It's not just in these sorts of settings or those. Yes. So let's pick one of the settings to look at. I am going to do a bit of a highlights tour of kind of tell me about this one, then this one, then that one. So with households or sort of home type settings, what can we learn by looking at the uniforms worn by people working in those particular environments?
I split my book up into chapters based on the types of employers, and the first chapter is about household employees, as you just said, about, you know, maids and porters, and these are a very old style of work uniform. They come out of practices from royal and noble households in Europe, and the tricky thing about that is that in those cases, the uniforms that you, for example, put your doorman in, it was clothes for them to wear in their working lives. However, they also had to take a particular form because doormen also guarded the entrance to the estate. And so they also served a security function, and in times of war would be a literal military uniform. So for people who worked inside the household who didn't have that security function, there was more looseness available. In fact, it was not uncommon for, you know, wealthy families to say, oh, you know, this dress is worn out, it's no longer in fashion, I'm just going to hand it off to my maid. Or, you know, even if you expected your maid to acquire their own clothing, it might be like, well, you know, I want you to kind of dress like me. Like, obviously you can't afford what I can afford, and it shouldn't be that fashionable. But, you know, like, there would be certain expectations, even if there wasn't, you know, like, here is this thing and everyone must look exactly the same. But for those doormen, there absolutely was. And that directly influenced how doormen in the U.S. came to look the way they do. Those are very old, archaic, elaborate types of uniforms. But household maids, so over time, thinking again specifically about the context in the U.S., wealthy households in the late 1800s, so this is the Gilded Age, right? Tremendous wealth. One family that I looked at was the James J. Hill family in Minnesota. So he was the CEO of a railroad in the northern U.S., extremely wealthy man. When he built his residence in the late 1800s, it was the single most expensive residence in the entire state of Minnesota. And when I looked him up in the 1900 U.S. Census, at the time, the family had 11 live-in servants, which is just an astonishing number. I mean, yeah, a lot of wealthy households could afford, you know, two or three people, but have 11 people and they're all living full-time in your home. Like, that just really shows how tremendously wealthy that family was. And then because of their prominence and wealth, there also are lots of photographs of them in the, you know, historical society, which is located not far away from the home. In fact, the James J. Hill House is now part of the Minnesota Historical Society. And so I could see what those servants were wearing. And so you see, if you didn't know they were servants, you might not think there was anything very unusual about what they were wearing. The style of the clothing was not that different from what people were ordinarily wearing. It was a kind of, you know, late Victorian, you know, big sleeves, small waist, you know, petticoats underneath, very full skirt, very modest ankle length skirt, high neckline, and then an apron, white cuffs, and mob caps. And this was very much in line with what household servants in Europe were still wearing. But you can start to see a little bit of, you know, standardization and similarity going on. So in one photograph I have in the book, you can see that the two household maids standing in the back are dressed exactly alike. They have the same dark colored dress, you know, white apron, cuffs, and mob cap. And then there are two female servants sitting in front who are dressed differently, but like each other. So they're both wearing a white dress. And then there is one male servant in the middle. And because there's only one man pictured, I can't really say anything about the similarity there. But when you start looking at other households in that same time period, you see these shapes repeated. So wealthy people were talking to one another. And as you know, you'd go check in on your friends and this maid would greet you at the door, you'd think like, oh, that's great. Like, look how sharp the maids look at the Hill House. Like, I want my maid to look like that too. And so people would get ideas about how their maids should dress and then enforce those ideas. And, you know, in these household settings, it's a very intimate environment. People see everything that's going on in your daily life. You know them very well as you could know any kind of employee, but it's a very coercive, very, there's a big imbalance of power there, because if your employer tells you, you know, as a maid who's living in their home, here's what you need to wear, what kind of choice do you have? If you refuse, not only are you out of a job, but you're out of a place to live. So it's a very high stakes situation, and it's understandable that, you know, uniforms would be decided, you know, without much input probably from the staff, and enforced in a very, you know, controlling, sometimes even punitive way.
Well, and that answer, I think, also helpfully helps us understand why things, for example, like maid uniforms, change over time. Mm. And you document in the book, yes, kind of, you know, as this normal street fashion did this with women's dresses, here's how the maid uniforms also changed, which, given the context right. you've just explained, now makes a ton of sense. But why didn't that happen, for example, with porter's uniforms?
Oh, sure. Okay. So one thing that's important to know about the maid's uniforms is that as mass production started to kick in, including for women's clothing, which really didn't happen until the early 20th century, maid's uniforms were being sold in department stores because that's where wealthy women shopped. And so they had advertised in newspapers like, oh, you know, come and see the latest maid's uniforms that we have. This would make a great Christmas present for your maid. And that's where, you know, these employers were acquiring their uniforms. But because they're being sold in department stores and reflected on like the good taste of the employer who was buying these uniforms, there was a kind of natural impulse to like change with fashion, you know, because you don't want your maid to be like, oh, look how dowdy they are. Like you want them to be, you know, not like super fashionable, but wearing something that reflects well on the taste of the woman of the house. But porters, on the other hand, so I concentrated my book on Pullman porters. It was a very specific company that hired exclusively Black men to work as porters. There were other train companies as well that also, in many cases, hired Black men, not necessarily exclusively. But Pullman train cars were also, at least at their inception, designed for wealthy travelers, because if you got on a Pullman train car, instead of having to get off the train at a station and, you know, connect to your next train, you would just stay in the car and the train company would actually detach those cars and hook them up to the next train. So you could sleep on the car, you could recline, you could really, you know, eat fine meals and just, you know, relax and luxuriate as everyone else did all the work for you. So it was a very exclusive situation. But the men who worked as porters, again, there's already a huge imbalance of power because their employers are exclusively white. All the conductors are white and the porters are only Black men. So that already was a power imbalance. But then also from the very beginning, the Pullman Palace Car Company, one of their board members was a department store owner in Chicago, and they made a deal that this department store would supply all of the uniforms for the porters. So if you were a porter, not only were you required to acquire a uniform and actually had to purchase it with your own money, and you had to, of course, wear it while you were employed, but you could also only buy it from this one department store in Chicago, regardless of where you lived and your personal life. I mean, Chicago was a major train hub, so it wasn't that, I'm sure like many train routes went through Chicago, so it wouldn't have been that hard to get there, but still, it wasn't like they were like, oh, you know, you could go to this department store in Philadelphia or Boston or Los Angeles or, you know, whatever major cities. It was just Chicago. And so that controlled those uniforms very, very tightly. There were also restrictions. You had to be, you know, of a certain height, but not too tall. You had to be not too, like there were restrictions, like even still there are restrictions for flight attendants on how much you could weigh, because you had to be able to fit in the train cars and do all the jobs that were expected, and also like fit the certain size range of uniforms. So this meant that, you know, they were really self-selecting for a very particular type of man, particular size, and the uniforms didn't have to change very much. There was really no incentive for them to change because the passengers weren't employing the porters, the train company was. It didn't reflect on the taste of the train passengers the same way that it did with household maids. So there was really no reason for the porters to be in fashion like there would have been for maids. Yeah.
Got it. No, that's helpful to kind of disentangle who's in control and how that impacts the decision making. I want to kind of pick up on something, though, you mentioned towards the end of that about the rules side of it, not just in terms of taste or branding, but in terms of like regulations. You talk about that instance, but also other ones in the book where you've got regulations and even in some cases laws around uniforms. Can you talk a bit about that and how they influence kind of these sorts of things about change or not?
Sure. So, I mean, sometimes there are very specific laws that regulate uniforms. Other times there are laws that more broadly regulate uniforms. So I'll give you an example of each one of those. So a very specific law would be there is a law that says if you are not a U.S. postal worker, you cannot dress like one. And specifically what that drills down to is, so postal uniforms are actually really interesting because if you're a postal employee, there is a law that says that you don't have to buy your own uniforms. Money will be supplied to you. And that started in the 1950s. So when you get that money, there is a list of over 200 vendors. And you as an employee today get to go through that list and decide where you want to spend the money. And I'm sure that postal employees are, you know, of course, thinking about the weather, also like, you know, what are your peers wearing? Like, I'm sure that people do want to have some similarity. But you can really tailor what you're wearing to your personal needs. But if I am not a postal employee, like I could go to one of those suppliers. So let's say like Flying Cross, for example, is a brand that sells button-down shirts to a number of different government agencies, police, firefighters, postal workers. Like they're a huge supplier of these button-down shirts. I can buy a Flying Cross button-down shirt just as a normal, you know, person in the US. I could even buy, even outside of the US, I could buy that branded shirt. But if I wanted to buy a Flying Cross shirt with the Postal Service emblem, I have to prove that I'm a postal employee in order to buy that current emblem. So, and that ties into that direct law saying that if you're not a postal worker, you can't dress like one. But more broadly, there are laws that regulate other things like, for example, so the last chapter in my book of data is about adult entertainment uniforms. And of course, we have laws about, you know, gender discrimination and how, you know, in most situations, you can't be like, we're only hiring men or we're only hiring women. However, through a number of court cases, there has been a legal standard established called the Bona Fide Occupational Qualifications Standard that says in very particular situations, if employers can prove that there is some characteristic that is needed for the job and it's an intrinsic part of the job, then you can discriminate. So there are situations in which you can restrict body size, you can restrict gender presentation if it is needed. Like for example, like cocktail waitresses in casinos. Now, I mean, some casinos have voluntarily said, hey, look, we're hiring both men and women. This is not just a women's occupation. Of course, in mostly it's women who are self-selecting into those kinds of jobs, but men are not forbidden from taking them. But this is something that those kinds of employers have really had to carefully negotiate with different levels of government over, you know, situations in which they are allowed to be somewhat discriminatory because they have defined it as part of the job. So it is very complicated. There's lots of different, I mean, laws, for example, around civil rights, you know, religious discrimination, whether you can, you know, wear religious apparel items as part of your job, racial discrimination, you know, like now the situation I mentioned with only Black men could be Pullman porters, like that kind of hiring situation could absolutely no longer exist. It's just completely unacceptable under US law. So laws do change over time and some are very broad and you wouldn't necessarily see how it ties directly into work uniforms, but then there are other laws that are very specific.
Hmm. Yeah, no, a really interesting kind of two categories, one of which you would see and one of which you might not think of. And sort of similarly on that vein, I mean, I feel like everything we've talked about so far has kind of been like the you know, who's pulling the strings behind the curtain that you may not have thought of. So adding, right. I suppose, to that list, can we talk about uniform manufacturers and what they, the role they've played or the influence they've had in uniforms being adopted for certain industries in impacting this change over time question we keep coming back to?
Sure. Okay. So I guess a couple of good examples that come to mind. So one of the first manufacturers that I know of for uniforms. It was a small company known as TD Angelica. So that name is actually, it stands for Theresa Del Angelica. Her name was really lost in the historical record for a long time, but she was a German immigrant living in Milwaukee, and she married a man named Cherubino Del Angelica, who worked for the railroads. He was an Italian immigrant living in Chicago. And Theresa was a seamstress, and the legend, Angelica Company was bought out in the 1980s, so it no longer exists as a standalone company, but there is still some information online about them because they were a very prominent manufacturer of waitressing uniforms and medical uniforms and linens for decades. So there is still information about them online. But the mythology is that, Cherubino was apparently working for the railroads as a chef. And Theresa designed a uniform for him that was a double-breasted white coat. And people liked it so much that she started getting requests to make others that were like it. And apparently this idea took off. They ended up moving to St. Louis and established a garment manufacturing business. They lived above it. So their workshop was on the ground floor level, and then they lived above the workshop. And that's where Theresa worked for the rest of her life. Technically, the business at that time was called Gents Furnishing, and it was owned by Cherubino. However, he died in a shipwreck in the 1880s, and in his will, he left the business. He split it up between his three children, who were his children from a previous marriage, but they were still just teenagers when he died in the shipwreck. And then he left the other share to Theresa and clearly indicated his will that she should continue to manage the business and that his children should help her with that business. And so when she took over, she had a couple of side businesses of her own, but she ended up consolidating them and she renamed the entire business TD Angelica after her own name. So she really was a very early entrepreneur. During a time in which it was very difficult for women in the U.S. to own property, they couldn't have their own bank accounts. So I don't know all the details about how she managed to make that work, but she did establish this thriving business under her own name. And so in the 1880s, she was asked to design uniforms for a new series of businesses that was opening called the Fred Harvey restaurants, or known as Harvey Houses. So Fred Harvey had this idea that as the railroads were expanding in the West, that he not only wanted to supply passengers with food, but he wanted to create a series of fine dining establishments. So this is way before McDonald's. This is really a very interesting idea. So the way that these restaurants work is if you're a train passenger, you would, someone on the train, a staff member, would come and take your order. And once all the orders were collected, they would use telegraph lines to relay all the orders ahead to the restaurant. So by the time the train arrived at the station, you would get off, go to the restaurant, all your food would be ready and set up. White linens, real silver, porcelain, you know, dinner plates. So you'd have this great meal all waiting for you. It'd only take half an hour to eat because everything was already set up. And then you get back on the train. And at first, Fred Harvey had men working for him as waiters, but they were kind of too rowdy. They kept getting into fights and getting into trouble. And so he decided that he really needed women to work for him instead as waitresses, because they would provide this, you know, more gentle, you know, caretaking, nurturing kind of touch. And so he recruited young women, mostly from the Midwest. He did this through newspaper advertisements. But this was kind of a tough sell because it was not normal at that time for young women to leave home and work independently. I mean, this was like, you know, that was like something prostitutes did, not something that like good girls were supposed to do. So in order to preserve their reputation, he built dormitories next to the restaurants where the waitresses would live. And then he also, commissioned Theresa Dell'Angelica to create these uniforms. So their uniforms were actually much like the James J. Hill servants, you know, ankle-length black dresses, white apron, white cuffs, a little, you know, white headdress, and really kind of nun-like, but really did the job. So these women had this very, you know, professional appearance, made it clear that they were served the customers, they were all dressed alike, although, you know, it was not mass production on the scale that we think of today. Like, certainly Angelica was creating the same type of uniform over and over. And regardless of what Harvey House you went to, the waitresses would all look the same from one place to another. So Fred Harvey established this very clear brand for his houses and his waitresses. And that style persisted for decades. I have discovered since I wrote the book that actually in, so the Harvey House brand no longer exists. In the 20s and 30s, the style of the uniforms did start to change a little bit, still always black and white, but the hemlines did raise a little. So they did start to make some tweaks, but still the idea of like, you could go to any Harvey House and they would look exactly the same. That was a really new concept for work uniforms. So that's a really early example. And then one other one I want to mention a little, this is a quicker story, but in the 1930s, as gas stations were really starting to brand themselves, they were trying to encourage customers to have loyalty. So it was like, you know, Texaco and Esso and whatever your brand was, they were like, how can we get customers to keep coming back? Because they're all selling the same thing. Like, gas is gas, regardless of where you go. But how can I get a customer to be like, oh, you know, I trust Esso and I want to keep going to Esso stations wherever I see them. Like, that's the brand for me. And so there was a small manufacturer, which eventually became Unitog. This guy started selling uniforms out of the trunk of his car. And at first he only sold like three or four types of things. And so he started like literally driving up to gas stations and being like, you know, hey, do you want to buy some uniforms for your attendants? And as the idea picked up, they started asking him like, you know, hey, you know, you have some nice designs. Could you, like make them in a color that's specific to Esso. Like, this is the blue we're using for our branding. Could you make uniforms that are just for us that have the same color? And of course he was like, yeah, sure, no problem. So by the 1950s, he was actually like no longer selling out of the trunk of his car, but actually had like ordering blanks that were specific for, and it wasn't just limited to Esso. He like had different ordering forms for all different, you know, Gulf Oil and Texaco and all the different gas station companies, all specifically, you know, colors for their brands. And so, you know, you could order like, you know, hey, if I am managing a Texaco station and I have five employees and I want to have them all look the same, you'd get your ordering blank and you'd like take their measurements and decide what you wanted them to wear. And then you would send this in with, you know, all the money that was necessary. And Unitog would send you the uniforms. You didn't have to go to a store to look for them. You didn't have to, you know, commission a local seamstress to make the right thing. Like, this manufacturer was like, hey, you want your branded uniforms? I'm ready to supply them. And it just became this really, you know, synergistic practice. So that's how a lot of uniform companies work today.
Interesting. That is such a fascinating insight to think of, and kind of the trajectory of both of those companies as well gives us a lot to reconsider next time we see someone in a uniform like that. Can I ask about another example of uniforms that have like really clear branding? In fact, you already mentioned kind of just how much the branding is regulated for them. Post office workers. Because you talk about them being like, on the one hand, uniforms and work uniforms per the definition you talked about at the beginning, but that these ones kind of are the closest maybe to military. Why do post office workers look like military soldiers? Like, what is happening here practically, ideologically? Why?
Right. Oh, I want to mention too, I mean, I couldn't mention this in my book because of copyright, but it's exactly like the Beatles song, right? Like, may I look a little like the military man. Like, so it's not a coincidence. Anyway, okay, so there's a couple of reasons that postal workers look so much like soldiers. So one is very practical. So military uniform. So the U.S., I mean, you know, it's no secret that the U.S. is a very militaristic country, and we have fought a lot of wars over the last two centuries. And so there is a whole infrastructure in place. This is something that I'm doing some new research about now, but the quartermaster depot has a long history of, you know, okay, well, if you need, you know, 20,000 uniforms, how are you going to get them as quickly as possible? And so over time, this whole system of like contracting and subcontracting and mass production has developed. And it's easy, you know, for other government workers, whether that's like, you know, park rangers, firefighters, police departments, to be like, hey, you know, this infrastructure is already developed. The military already has all these suppliers. Why don't we just work with them? And also for those manufacturers that have government contracts, you know, if I'm like making, like, let's say socks for the military, well, you know, okay, maybe right now it's like war's going on and I'm really just, you know, cranking out socks and just making, you know, tens of thousands of pairs. But then, you know, the war ends. Well, I don't want to fire all my workers and, you know, stop producing. Like, I need to find some other business. And a very natural other kind of business is other government workers. So if I'm like, okay, well, you know, I usually make socks for the military, but, you know, hey, postal workers could wear the same socks and firefighters could wear the same socks. It's really easy to just start advertising to those, you know, organizations as well. And it, likewise, it's also really easy, especially for federal agencies. Once a federal supplier is in the system, it's really easy for a different federal agency to be like, oh, we're just going to use the same supplier. They're already in the system. It's, you know, easy. They've already been vetted. We can pay them. You know, couldn't be more simple. So it's a, like, strategically, it just makes a lot of sense for other federal employers. And same thing within state systems. Once, you know, a manufacturer is in the state system, it's really easy for other state agencies to buy from them. But the other reason that they have this militaristic look is because when you start thinking about like what postal workers do and what park rangers do, they are also government authorities. So like a postal worker, you know, is going up to people's houses. And again, the U.S. is very militaristic. Gun ownership is very widespread. And if I'm just going up to random people's houses as a postal worker, I want people to be able to identify me and know that I have a good reason for being there. Because otherwise, you might be in real physical danger. Mm. I mean, you might anyway, but the fact that you're identifiable and, you know, and those government workers really, you know, not always, but in many cases really work hard to build trust, to be like, you know, I'm safe. I'm just doing a job. Here's who I am. You can trust me. And so that's what those uniforms need to do. They need to convey, like, you know, it's very clear who I am. You don't need to think twice. Like, it's very visually obvious and you can trust me. So that's why those uniforms have to be the way they are.
That makes a lot of sense. I'd like to ask you to expand a bit on kind of the first part of that answer, the more sort of practical logistic side of, you know, it's once you're in the system, it's easy to order from. That obviously makes sense of kind of who is paying for the uniforms when it is sort of military, when it is state, when it is that sort of level. Right. But if we move beyond that aspect, that kind of category of uniforms and who buys them, if we go back to thinking about maids or restaurants or, you know, whatever it might be kind of outside of the state aspect, who is paying for uniforms? Is it sort of standard? Does it differ across types of employers?
It does vary dramatically depending on the type of employer. So government uniforms, by and large, This was not always the case, and workers actually had to unionize and fight very hard for these rights. But at this point in time, government workers generally expect that if they're required to wear a uniform, it will be provided for them, and they will not be charged for it. It's a benefit and not a burden to them. However, outside of government workers, that expectation is not necessarily there. There are cases in which, so for example, like this is really common with corporate employers. If I worked for like, let's say Chase Bank, Chase might adopt the government model and be like, you know, hey, as a benefit, I'm giving you $500 per year. You decide what you want to wear, but here's how we want you to look. So Chase, for example, one of the companies they contract with is Lands' End. So you go on the Lands' End website, you open their portal, you know, Chase has already preloaded your $500 and you just select what you want to wear and Lands' End sends it to you. It could be a situation. There are cases where, let's say you're a fast food worker. There are certainly, you know, fast food companies that'll be like, oh, you're working for us. Here's your, you know, 5 free t-shirts to wear as your uniform. Just keep them clean. That's all we ask, but they're yours to keep. There are also employers, especially smaller fast food companies where they're really working on very tight margins. They might be like, you know, we want you to wear this uniform. You need to wear it if you want to stay employed here. But, you know, we're taking this money out of your first paycheck. So they might supply it, but it's not a benefit. It's not free to you. You have to pay for it. So it's a real tricky place. You don't get any choice about how much to pay or where to buy it. And it is expected that you're going to wear it, but it's not just given to you. There are, however, other situations where the rules are pretty loose and you are required to buy your uniforms. It actually presents an opportunity to have some choice. So, and the best example for this is a wide variety of medical workers are expected to wear scrubs, but the color and the style is up to you and you're the one who buys them. So if you go like look today, you know, online or like old school, you look in a phone book and you look for companies that sell uniforms, it is almost always going to be the case that if you go looking for work uniforms to buy just in a retail store today, they're almost all going to be medical uniforms, scrubs, because those are the workers who are most likely today to buy their own uniforms. But it also means that there are literally dozens of companies that make scrubs, and there are some that are actually really fashionable. You can buy them in every color you can imagine, different kinds of patterns. Like if you work, you know, let's say in like a pediatric dentist office, there are all kinds of like fun, colorful, like cartoon patterns that appeal to kids that aren't going to scare them. You can, you know, if you're like, oh, you know, I want to buy this because it's Valentine's, I'm going to buy this because it's the Christmas season. Like those scrubs are out there waiting for you. You could buy a different pair every week and be as fashionable as you want, as long as they're still recognizable as scrubs.
Hmm. Scrubs actually kind of brings me to another thing I wanted to ask, because
sure,
there are so many options available with scrubs, as you mentioned.
Yes.
And also kind of regardless of the type, that the decisions seem to be a lot more about kind of the color and the pattern rather than sort of traditional, like these are men's scrubs, these are women's scrubs. It's kind of like, well, yeah, scrubs sort of look the same regardless. The question is more like, do they have duckies on them? Right.
Right.
And of course, that didn't used to be the case, right? Like nurses used to have to wear something really quite specific, and yes, other sectors still have quite different uniforms expected for different genders within them. Scrubs, yes, don't. Why, right, do some sectors seem to continue to have gender differences, whereas others are kind of like, nah, everyone can kind of wear whatever?
Right. Well, okay, yes, definitely that does vary tremendously by the industry. So I'll give you a few examples of how they can range and why. So yeah, scrubs at this point are truly unisex. You can buy scrubs that have a more feminine appearance, you don't have to, and there is no expectation that you should. For a woman to wear scrubs that look exactly the same as her male counterparts, whether she's a nurse, doctor, x-ray technician, whatever, there is absolutely no barrier to doing that. But that is a really hard fought battle over a period of decades. Because if you look back at what, you know, nurses and doctors were wearing in the late 1900s, early 1900s, or yeah, late 1800s, early 1900s, they were extremely gendered. Women were nurses, they were never doctors. Men were doctors, they were never nurses. And the two types of uniforms that they were completely different. In fact, male doctors were very reluctant to adopt uniforms and really didn't until the early 20th century. So it took a very long time for the medical profession to get to the point where people were like, yep, women can be doctors too, men can be nurses too, and we should just all dress the same. And the way we're all going to dress the same is by wearing scrubs. And that transition really happened by the 1980s. The 70s, you still saw some interest in having different uniforms for men and women. But really by the 80s, all of that was gone and it had switched completely to scrubs and lab coats. I mean, you do sometimes still see like doctors wearing a white button-down lab coat instead, or in like highly sterile situations, you'll see some differences. But for the most part, like, it's not a gendered difference anymore. There are some industries that are still in the process of changing. So for example, flight attendants. Now, interestingly enough, the first flight attendants were all nurses. They were required to be nurses because flying was still considered so dangerous that women, and it was all women who worked as nurses, as flight attendants, had to be registered nurses because they needed that kind of medical training to like take care of the passengers properly. And so that idea just got really cemented in place. And then flight attendants, until very recently, have also been highly gendered. It was, you know, a situation where until really like this century, it was very rare for men to work as flight attendants, who of course originally were called stewardesses, but that was a gendered term. So flight attendant is the unisex term. And you do now have men who work as flight attendants, but interestingly enough, very recently, airlines have started to move toward gender neutral uniforms. So Alaska Airlines was one of the first to do this. Virgin Airlines has also adopted a gender neutral uniform policy. And what that looks like is they are now providing a menu of different uniform options. So there is a skirt and there are pants and there are vests and jackets. And you as an individual can choose among that menu of options and decide what you feel the most comfortable wearing, regardless of how you identify in your gender, whether you identify as female or as male or as non-binary or trans, doesn't matter. You decide what you feel the most comfortable in. So the company decides what the menu is, but you select within the menu. That is an option that I think a lot more companies will be moving towards. But on the far end of the spectrum in terms of uniforms that are still really gendered, you see this especially in adult entertainment situations. Cocktail waitresses, I mean, this actually, I was surprised in my research at how long these gender uniforms have been in place and how much they have changed over the years, even while maintaining a highly gendered appearance. So there have been quite a variety of occupations that fit within this, starting with barmaids in the late 1800s. Then you moved into cigarette girls, car hops, topless dancers, topless donut shop workers. I mean, just all kinds of unusual situations. And then more recently, Hooters girls and restaurant workers. So there are actually lots of different restaurant chains in the U.S. Hooters is probably the best known only because it actually does exist in other countries. For the most part, this is an industry that is very specific to the U.S. It does not translate well in most other countries, and most restaurant chains have not attempted to branch out into other countries. But the uniforms in these businesses are very sexualized. They're very tight-fitting. They're very specific for men and women. In a lot of cases, men are not even working in these occupations. It is very gendered female and very feminine in terms of presentation. So there's a very tight idea of how these women should look, down to, you know, body shape and use of cosmetics and hairstyles. So it's a very, very scripted, just very tightly managed uniform style that includes the body itself. That is going to be really resistant to change. I think if you talk to workers in those industries, a lot of times they're self-selecting into them and don't necessarily, and I don't want to shame workers who choose to work in those jobs. I think, you know, if that's your choice and it works for you, you know, rock on. But I think it's an industry that's very resistant to changing that gender norm.
Hmm. Yeah, no, thank you for taking us through a range of them. And as you said, the reasons for why, because I think that's quite helpful to understand. If I can ask, sort of as we come towards the end of the interview, for a bit of a, I guess, behind the scenes type question.
Sure.
Obviously, there were a lot of things as I was reading the book where I was like, oh, I hadn't thought of that, or oh, that's an interesting example I didn't know of, or okay, that's an interesting looking uniform. Is there anything that when you were doing the research or putting the book together, anything that you came across that particularly surprised you, whether or not it actually made it into the book?
Yeah. Okay. So one thing that really surprised me was, so in the book about government employees, I intentionally chose not to write about the police, just because that's a really like rich, intense topic in itself, and it deserves its own book. I felt like it was really going to overwhelm what I was doing if I started writing about the police. Like, there's just too much to write about. So I chose to focus very specifically on meter maids. So one thing that surprised me when I started learning about meter maids, because of course I was also like, well, you know, why meter maids, was I assumed that parking meters were probably invented in like New York City, but they were invented in Oklahoma City. That really surprised me. So this was in the 1929, if I remember correctly, is when the patenting process started. The meter maid was the first instance I can tell where people started calling women who enforced parking meters meter maids was in Salt Lake City, Utah in the 1950s. This really reinforced to me the value of deliberately looking for regional examples of work uniforms. One thing that I think fashion studies has really suffered from is that because so much fashion production occurs in major cities, especially in New York and Los Angeles, and there is production in other places, you know, Columbus, Ohio, Chicago. I mean, I can think of other regional examples, but really like New York and Los Angeles are very dominant in the fashion industry in the United States. And so that's where the fashion studies scholarship goes, even looking at consumers. Like, we really focus on consumers even in those two areas. But with work uniforms, the industry is much more diverse, or, you know, much more spread out regionally. There's some really, really interesting regional examples. Like, one thing I ran across looking at doorman uniforms was a postcard of a doorman at a hotel in Cincinnati, which no longer exists. The building's still there, but the hotel went out of business, I think in the 80s, if I remember correctly. At the time that it was built in the 1950s, it was a very futuristic hotel. It was one of the first to have elevators that the customers could operate themselves. There wasn't specifically an elevator man who had to do it for you. It also had, when you went to your rooms, apparently the beds also pulled out with the touch of a button. So there was some like mechanization that was very unusual for uniforms or for hotels at the time. They also had Juan Miró do a mural for the hotel's restaurant. And I think this was his first commission in the US. So they were like very avant-garde, very, you know, culturally progressive. But the so they had a lounge called the Casbah Lounge. It was this very orientalist fantasy. And this postcard that I found described the doorman as Abdullah the doorman. So just like straight up Orientalism. And his uniform, this poor man, was like a cream colored tunic with a red sash and a cream and red turban and black pants and black shoes. And this is how he was dressed up to, you know, welcome people into the Kasbah. And I mean, I am sure that he did not choose that uniform for himself. That was selected for him. So that meets my definition of what a uniform is. It's an unusual uniform, although doorman uniforms can be really outrageous. I haven't had time to go looking for a lot more regional examples of doorman uniforms, but I bet there are some really unique examples out there. So this is a really rich area that I'm hoping other people are going to pick up the baton and go digging for other examples, because I am sure they're out there.
Very intriguing. Thank you for sharing those with us. Speaking, sure, though, of what might come from this book, obviously others might pick up the baton, but what are you working on now or next?
At the moment, I'm working on an exhibit that's not related to this book at all. It's with my other work on Islamic fashion. But in terms of uniforms, so I have a couple of things going on. In May, I am speaking at a trade convention for uniform manufacturers. It's for the Network Association of Uniform Manufacturers and Distributors, which is based in the U.S. And I'm going, you know, to talk about my work on the history of work uniforms, and especially to network. I really can't wait to meet some people who are working for these companies and just see, you know, hear what's on their minds and learn from them. I'm taking some students with me. I also have launched a website called uniformhistories.us, in which I am right now, I have part of my research collection of uniforms online. There are more examples of uniforms that did not make it into my book. My collection is larger than what you see in my book. At times it was really hard to choose the photographs because I just had so many great examples. And so I'm really excited to share more of those examples online. And my intention for that website is for it to be a virtual museum and resource for other scholars, for costume designers, for, you know, for films, for example, for people who are reenactors, for manufacturers of uniforms in the industry today. I want there to be this repository of historical examples, just like we have repositories of historical fashion. I don't know that anyone's ever going to build a physical museum of uniforms, but all of these things can live in this virtual space, and we can really, you know, share and learn from one another. I am hoping that some of these companies, I know that some of them have corporate archives, and I'm hoping they will start to collaborate with me so that we can really share these resources more broadly. There are so many things that I have a sense are out there and I just wasn't able to access in the course of my research. And I think there's just really a huge pool of material waiting to be discovered and shared.
Well, that's exciting. I hope someone, yeah, kind of, you know, I'm very curious to see what comes from this, given that little preview. But of course, listeners can also, in addition, if they want to, reach out and get engaged in that work, but also read the book we've been discussing, titled On the Job, A History of American Work Uniforms, published by Bloomsbury in 2024. Heather, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It was really a pleasure to talk about this and to hear your thoughts.